SciFiForMe.com, where all of us have secret identities.
This is Sci-Fi for Chicks, this is our Sleepy Hollow podcast, and this is the mid-season penultimate episode that I'm calling Snakes. Why'd it have to be snakes?
The question is, who am I?
Right. I'll give you a clue. You have a minute to guess the identity of the person in question.
We must find a weapon to defeat Moloch. I fail to understand how a game played on telephones will help us solve our dire problem at hand.
It won't. That's the point. This is a technique profilers use to crack cases when they're stuck. If you distract the conscious mind, the subconscious makes connections that you wouldn't have seen before. My mother believed that Grace Dixon hid some clues in her journal. We've gone over it so many times, we practically memorized it, and still nada. So, you cannot tell a lie. Who are you?
Oh, the little wooden puppet boy.
Pinocchio.
Yes.
Nope, guess again.
George Washington. He was our liar in chief. He formed the Culper spy ring. That was a network of liars.
Thank you, colonial myth buster.
On a plane.
Not on a plane. Indiana Jones. Oh my gosh. That's not that old.
No, it isn't, but on a plane.
Alex will not be calling the episode that, but that's what I'm calling it. And since I'm the engineer on this episode, I get to call it what I want to call it. Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi for Chicks. My name is Heather, and I am joined, of course, by my supernatural sister who is sticking her tongue out at me, I'm sure. Alex. Hey, Alex.
Hello, everybody.
So, you didn't realize that this was the penultimate mid-season episode, that we only have one more episode of Sleepy left.
Yeah, I was so sure that it was mid-season finale. Because the ending was just so mid-season finale that it didn't even occur to me that there's another episode. Like, why would you destroy such a perfect cliffhanger? That final shot was, and we will see you in 4 weeks, if that.
I know, it was crazy, because I was thinking the exact same thing. I went into it knowing it was the penultimate episode. And then I had, of course, my own cliffhanger, because right in the middle of Sleepy Hollow, we had the Ferguson grand jury decision come back. So, of course, everything on TV was interrupted by this, and my DVR didn't take that into account. And so it cut off, like, 2 minutes before the end. I'm like, no! I felt very Darth Vader. So I guess that would actually be more... No. I'm like, it's getting to the good point. And then when I finally caught up this morning and I saw it, I'm like, but this is, there's still one more before we, but this is.
Exactly.
That's a cliffhanger. What else do you have in store for us next week to make it a mid-season cliffhanger? That is crazy.
Yeah. You have to wonder and be a little scared. What is it that they have that's so big and so suspenseful that they have, you know, this one cliffhanger that left us all in awe, basically. And then there's another episode in next week. Just, I am worried. I am worried, and not in a good way.
It's crazy. I don't know. I'm really anticipating something that could be really fantabulously wonderful and is going to make me really hate the holiday season because there won't be any resolution for many, many several weeks. Something that I was wrong on, and I'm really glad I was wrong on. I thought there was only 16 episodes, but from what I read, next week is the 11th episode, and when we come back, we'll have 7 more. So we actually have an 18 episode season.
Sweet.
Which I'm glad. Because last year they did their mid-season break and came back and did 3 episodes and they were done. And I'm like, what? How do you come back for 3 episodes and then you're done? This is not Lost. This is, don't keep me waiting 9 months for any kind of
resolution. Let's be fair. Those last 3 episodes, they were worth it.
Yes, they were. Which made it even worse though, because I was like, I just got back into the swing of it and you're awesome.
And now see you're next gone. Year.
So when we do come back, we'll have 7 episodes. So that'll be very, very cool. I'm looking forward to that.
Me too. Though, you know, I'll let you know what's my final decision next week. How we'll see how much I hate the show by then.
Well, I think you'll like it a little bit more because next week, Hottie will be back. But we'll talk about that at the end.
We'll talk about it later.
I'm going to dangle that carrot in front of you. The Hottie carrot.
Aww.
Nope. There goes that tongue again, but not in the same way as earlier in the episode. We're going to be talking now about Sleepy Hollow Season 2, Episode 10, Magnum Opus. And to me, this really felt like the episodes of last season, when it was much more contained to our main characters. There wasn't all this extraneous stuff. You know, I loved Caroline, but we don't have any of those other characters. This was so focused, with the exception of a few small parts, on Abby and Crane. I thought that was really great. And I like that the other focuses that we had in there, it's Jenny and Irving. It's Katrina and Abe and Headless and Malik and Henry. It wasn't all this other stuff. So I really kind of like, it felt very season one to me.
Yeah, it was. I liked the feel of it. That's true. I missed when it was just the two of them against the world, against the monsters and everything. And I felt nostalgic when I was watching this episode. In a good way. So,
yeah.
It's like, there were moments when it felt like the writers were, I don't know, going back to the roots or something. Because they had this dynamic, this...
Their roots were showing, right?
Yeah, this formula that worked in season one. And it kind of got lost somewhere in season two. Sometimes not in a bad way, sometimes yes. For episodes that shall
we'll
not be
we'll get to
named.
That.
but yeah, they went back to that contained episode style where it was one big problem that they had to face and solve. And it was... I know I said it before that a lot of times what Abby and Crane were doing felt reactionary. They were reacting to what Henry... did, and that I missed them being proactive. Well, this episode, they had a plan, they were doing something, and it was Henry who was playing catch up.
Right.
So this was like, you know, the writers got my memo, thankfully, because I really loved that part, that Henry was the one playing catch up. Then he had
it
to...
felt very fresh again.
Exactly. After all those episodes when he was ahead, this was this felt new and exciting, and I really, really liked that.
And it was a really compelling episode in that. So, like I said, I had to watch it again. I needed to catch those final 2 minutes before we talked, and it was but I had other things I had to do. And so I put it on demand. Yay, Fox On Demand actually puts their episodes up right away, unlike some other networks. And I saw it and I started playing. I'm like, but I have all this other stuff I have to do. So I'll just put it on the TV, and I muted it while I'm doing all this other stuff around the house. Every time I walked by the TV, I stopped and was just mesmerized by the TV for a while. It was like, you know, this incredible silent movie that you just couldn't take your eyes off of, because I would keep it muted. I knew if I unmuted it, I would end up sitting down and watching the rest of the episode. I was like, I can't. I've got a cat that's really complaining, and I have to go do her bidding. She's my own Malik there, that I have to do her bidding. But I did. I just kept stopping and watching it. And visually, you didn't need the dialogue almost, because visually, you got the story. Visually, they were really there and compelling. Their faces, their bodies, everything for all the characters were really showing everything that they were feeling, thinking, needing to do. It was a really compelling episode. And then I get to the end, I'm like, okay, finally, I can unmute it now and I'll watch the end.
But I'm glad you pointed it out, because like many other Sleepy Hollow episodes, this one was also very vivid. and the way they shot it, and the colors and the lighting and everything worked so mm-hmm. well, because you could always always know what or who was in the scene just by what kind of lighting they used, or mm-hmm. you know, whether or not it was changing because there was fire from torches that Ichabod built, made from his socks. I am not over it. Or, you know, whether you should be worried because it was the colors were muted because it was Katrina and Henry and Moloch. I really like the way they are working the imagery and
yeah,
how they are setting up their shots. It's like, wow, guys, you do amazing job and keep doing it. Keep doing it.
Yeah, the photography mm. on this was really fabulous. This, I mean, everything, like you're saying, the lighting, the sets, the all of us was so working together, and all the actors, I felt, were really stepping up to that atmosphere around them, and just everything was just building on each other. I honestly go back and watch some of the sequences without sound, and it'll be just as compelling. Let's go ahead and talk about some of the episode, since the bulk of it is about Abby and Crane, really. Let's start with two of your favorites. Well, one of your favorites and one that you really do love too, but I know you have a special affinity for Captain Irving.
I do.
So let's talk about the Jenny and Irving sequences, and what did you think about how they dealt with that, how they put them in there, and what happened, what's going to happen?
Abby says they're setting up checkpoints all the way along 87, 81 in the side roads. We gotta get you across the border fast.
No texting while driving.
Always the cop.
I did all this for my family. I know I can't see them, but they don't know the truth.
You'll see them again. And we're gonna find a way to reclaim your soul. But first, we have to get you to safety.
You really think anywhere is safe anymore?
Frankly, I felt like because it was mentioned in the summary of the episode that Captain Irving and Jenny will be trying to get to Canada and all that, but in a way I felt like what we got was some false advertising, because maybe it was because Abby and Crane's scenes were so intense and overwhelming in a way that it felt that Irving and Jenny's scenes were a little bit of a cheat, like they were barely there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what I was expecting from their scenes, but what I got was a little disappointing. Because I get that we had to see Irving make a decision to stay and fight. I get that. Intellectually, mm-hmm. I get that they needed to put it somewhere because it's going to be extremely important later on. So I understand it, but I can't help feeling like his and Jenny's scene were treated more like a throwaway scenes. They needed to do them, so they did them, but I don't know, I expected more. I expected something that would match intensity to what we were given with Abby and Crane, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to explain it. It's just, when everything was so overwhelming and intense, with Abby and Crane especially, their scenes were almost underwhelming. And it was,
right.
They didn't match what we got with everything else. So maybe I got, like, emotional whiplash.
See, I kind of looked at them almost like what we've been complaining about on Gotham. I took it as that name drop scene. We don't want to suddenly appear in the next episode or on the other half of the break with suddenly this is what happened. And, oh, by the way, Jenny and Frank went off and did this, and then Frank blah, 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 blah. I took it as just kind of like that little, okay, just little connector. This isn't important to this story, but it will be important, and we just want to make sure you have a connection. And now we're going back to the main story. I have to admit that the writers are also staying on my, they're anticipating what I'm about to say. Because the minute I saw Jenny texting and driving, I'm like, what are you doing? Don't text and drive. And the next thing he says is, you know, you shouldn't text or drive. I'm like, okay. Mm. So at least they're still being anticipatory there with some of the things we're going to say and still trying to be cute. But I did like that we saw with Irving that that little scene showed that he's been thinking about things while he's been stuck in Tarrytown. Because what else did he have to do?
Yeah.
I've sold my soul to Moloch. My family, I did all this for my family, but people in the real world think I'm this murderer and blah, blah, blah. What's going to happen? If I get out of here, I need to do something. I almost, thinking about it afterwards, this morning I was kind of thinking, well, why did they do this and what's going to happen? And where is Irving going to go? Because I think Jenny is going to come back and be part of the Scooby Gang for this mid-season finale, which is where she should be. Jenny needs to be with her sister, with Crane, with Hottie, because we need Hottie to come back.
Always.
But I think Irving might end up with Katrina, because Irving has that part of him that's now on evil side. So I don't know if he's going to be compelled or something to do something. But I think that, I mean, Katrina is stuck with, let me finish. I know. Her hands are flying everywhere. She's got an idea. Katrina is stuck as this one lone, quote unquote, good person with Moloch and Henry and Abe Headless. It's like she needs somebody on her side, but Irving is, but he isn't, but he is, but he isn't. And I think that might help her story get better. So I'm hoping that he's going to end up with her and that'll help her be more than just this little damsel going, okay, okay. Yes, Horshack, you in the back. What do you want?
What if Frank answers the call of that thing that
That's true.
Henry. He could, well, I don't know if that's actually going to happen. I don't know, but how awesome would it be if he actually answered that call and showed up to the great, you know, I don't know, two horsemen waiting for their army to arrive or whatnot, to try and A, get his soul back, but B, that would put him in a place where he actually can help Katrina. Because I don't know about you, but I am pretty sure that because Henry holds his soul, he would not actually consider Frank as capable of betraying them, because Henry holds him in a way, you know, his being, and is, you know, in control of it. So it wouldn't even cross his mind that Frank is in a position and made a conscious decision to actually, you know, mess things up for him. How awesome would that be? It just, the thought of it gets me so excited that, yes, I am waving my arms around and that would be so cool.
She was very excited. Yeah, she's going to be out of breath now because she was flapping her arms so hard. Heather, shut up and let me talk. I think something like that would definitely play into some of the complaints that we've had and many other people have had this season. I mean, Frank being stuck in Tarrytown doing nothing. These episodes where his whole point was to call Henry so that Crane could then talk to Henry.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, lawyer, I'm going over here. Or the constant, we've seen that scene where he signs the contract with Henry so many times. It's like hitting us over the head. Yeah, we got it. He signed his soul over to Henry.
We got it the first time around. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I got it before you actually spelled it out for me. But now that I've seen it, I think they've shown it at least four times.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay.
At least.
I got it. So maybe there is some sort of play in with that, because Irving has been such a great character. That to have him relegated the way he has been this first half of the season, it's been painful. You've been very upset. We've The first episode, we were okay with it, but all the other episodes after that were like, come on, give us something.
I was not a happy camper, no.
It would be some really great things to have him do that. Like you said, maybe he's got this duality in him, you know, kind of like a Balthazar Cole kind of thing, mm-hmm. or like that angel duality where part of him, I don't know if he's in control of everything until at such time that his soul goes over to them, or if he's going to be compelled, or if he's split, like there's part of him that is pulled to that evil side and then part of him that's still pulling to the good. So I'm not sure how that's going to play, because there's so many different...
It depends on what their approach to the soul mythology is going to be.
Exactly, yeah. There's so many different ways that you can do that in mythology that I'm not sure where they're going to go with him. I like the idea of the pull,
mm-hmm.
not that he's totally compelled, but that maybe, you know, like that... you know, a dog to food kind of thing, where he's just pulled. Sorry, I was just with dogs earlier, and they were very much like that. Ooh, food, forget you. I like the idea of him having that pull, and maybe also feeling kind of lost that there's nothing to pull him back. And Katrina is somebody that could, because he knows she's on that side, and they haven't had a lot of interaction, and she hasn't had a lot to do either, other than be this damsel in distress, who thinks she's not in distress, but she is in distress.
It would be so awesome if they could create, like, I don't know, some magical dynamic duo. It would really make me one of the happiest people in the world, which isn't really easy, because I'm a horrible, horrible
That's
person.
That's true. It's not easy. It's not easy, people. Oh my God. I think it would be really cool to see Irving and Katrina as a pair there. I think that would be a really interesting mashup. And I think it could bring back some of the things we love about Irving and showcase some things in Katrina, because Crane knows Katrina from the past life. Mm-hmm. Abe knows Katrina from the past life. Henry has his idea of it. The sisters have their side on it. Irving, maybe he's also a little more empathetic, because Abby and Jenny are like, she's lost. She's, you know, she's totally on your son's side. Maybe the duality of her and the duality of Irving will play against each other really well.
Yeah, but before we start really, well, we, before I start having my hopes really up. let's talk about something else get too excited and then get terribly disappointed.
Well, we would have at least all a holiday, you know, Christmas, New Year's holiday to kind of go, oh, well, because I'll probably be dash next episode. Now, here's the thing I find very funny is we are 20 minutes in and have spent almost the last 10 minutes talking about Irving and Jenny. And this was something I thought, we'll talk about for 2 minutes and then move on. And I think we could actually even talk about it more. So this is scary.
Have you met me?
Writers, listen to our podcast. We have some really great ideas for the second half of the season that you've already written and started filming.
I don't care. We are the ones who are correct. They should just bow to our genius.
They should. Let's go ahead and, before we go on any further with the wonder that is Irving, and basically ignore Jenny, because she was just a chauffeur in this one. Jenny, we love you, but we need you to do something more. Let's go ahead and talk about the meat of this whole episode, which is Abby and Crane. And go.
Wow. That's
wherever you want to start.
No, that's my actual first reaction. Because after I finished watching the episode, it was like, wow, I missed that. I honestly missed that. And I missed their interaction. The whole know thyself. That was what is the episode was about, really. How Abby was the one who started as the one who was sure of herself. And she knew what she was about. And Crane, not so much. And then as the episode progressed, in the most organic way I've seen in a long time, their stance on whether or not they know themselves switched without them being obvious about what was happening. I don't know if I'm explaining it right. And then the whole end in the... I don't know what it was. Secret underground chamber of secrets.
Of secrets.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, because it was very Harry Potter to me. I'm like, this is Half-Blood Prince with the whole thing with the water, and you have to do something to get past it, and then reaching in and pulling the sword out to save all, and... Yeah, it was very Harry Potter Arthurian to me.
Yeah, but still, it was a trope that was used before. And I'm going to touch on the episode that shall not be named. Very much like the mystical
the Voldemort
pregnancy,
episode, yeah.
But the way it was done this time, it still felt fresh, like they were... doing something that fit the episode and fit the dynamics and the themes in the episode so well that I was like, okay, nice, keep going. What do you mean the episode is done?
Yeah.
I really loved it. Really, really did.
Well, since you touched on it, let's go ahead and talk about the episode that must not be named's influence in this. And I think they were listening to you or anticipating you. I think they were anticipating you and other people like you who don't like the mystical pregnancy, rapidly aging child.
Yeah.
We've gone from a baby to a youngster to a really brooding emo teen, which we just saw him like that very briefly, just that one shot. But I was like, he is such an emo underlord kind of thing there.
Yeah, I was surprised by how short his hair was. Because that kind of emo brooding just begged for this, like, Bieber kind of cut bangs over your hair, over your eyes, and just leave me all alone, let me listen to heavy metal and, you know, paint my nails black, like my soul.
Well, Teenage Moloch did seem to still be very much in the style of the 1780s with what he was wearing. So I don't know, maybe that's how teens did the whole... emo brooding back then.
Yeah, I'm going to take over the world. How's that for teenage rebellion?
Exactly. I don't want my own room. I want my own world.
Mm.
The way they did progress so fast. I mean, emo teen, he just had a look. He didn't even have a line. Like the youngster was, "Mother, I'm hungry." And that's his one line. We skipped through this really fast where, okay, now we're just at Moloch again. We don't have to deal with this mystical baby aging kind of thing. So how did you like the fact that the thing that you hated the most, we've pretty much skipped right through, and it's like, we had to do this. This is the path we went on. We're going to run down this path, sprint down this path really fast so that we don't have to deal with all this other crap.
Mm. Well, to date, the show that did rapid aging the fastest, basically, that I watched was Hex, which was a British TV show. Really good one, by the way. So if anyone wants to watch it, I recommend it. Because I think they did rapid aging baby drama in one episode. That was kind of awesome. Because, hey, let's rip that Band-Aid right off and we'll forget all about it. Sleepy Hollow took 3 episodes. Fine. Even though the
but not full episodes.
Yeah, still, you know, I'm counting them as 3 episodes.
Okay.
And yeah, now that the best thing that happened in the Katrina Henry scenes was Henry taking the charm off. The illusion.
Oh yeah.
Was gone, and with that,
yeah, that was good.
The idea that there is a blonde emo kid running around. This was like, I wanted to have a music file on my phone going, "Hallelujah, I am done and over, and we shall never mention it again. Thank you very much." And it's going to be now all about Moloch, who looks like Moloch. It is like thing, and I can finally wipe the episode that shall not be named from my memory and just headcanon it that Moloch managed to pull a ritual in purgatory to get into our world. And that's my headcanon from now on, because I can finally bleach my brain and forget about Deliverance. And oh my god, I am a happy camper.
Maybe when they were kind of fleshing out this season, one of the writers said that something like Moloch is born into this world, and that just got stuck in their heads, and they couldn't, you know, like sometimes when you get stuck on an idea and you can't see other possibilities, maybe they were like, born in, okay, we'll have to do the born thing, but oh, that's been done so many times, so we'll do it this way, and let's just do it real fast. We'll just, and we won't do a lot of casting, just a baby, a young kid and a teen, but they've got one scene and boop, we're done, you know. And then we go back to this cool, or maybe they needed also more time to make that bodysuit for Moloch, you know, even creepier looking than it had been in the
early part of the season. Any explanation that doesn't consist of they thought it was a good idea is good with me. Any excuse, any explanation, any excuse, I'm going to take it. I am desperate to regain my faith in those writers. So, sure, it was because the suit took long time to make. I can take it, I can buy it, whatever works. Unless we're totally wrong and they did think it was a good idea.
No, it was just they needed to buy time to make the suit creepier. If it helps you, we're going with that.
That's our headcanon.
I know my part as your podcasting partner.
Yes.
We gotta.
And to the listeners make it nice for Alex. Who think they will mess with my headcanon. This is the official headcanon for all the sleepyheads. Remember it, write it down, and stick to it. Thank you very much.
Exactly.
Your PSA is over.
So while we were going to go into Abby and Crane, we have digressed. On topic digression, but we digressed into.
I know, I'm sorry.
Katrina. No, that's fine. Let's go ahead and finish that up. I like that she thinks she's using the mirror to contact Crane, like she's being so deceptive. And Henry actually had planned it that way, and he reveals to her that this is that he let her do this because he was doing this connection. I think that's going to help her see, because when she came back and said that one line, oh, it's nice to see you've taken up an instrument. It was catty.
Yes.
It was a good line from her. And it was one of her actually seeing that side of it. So maybe she'll start seeing a separation. Yes, he is your son, but here's the evil side. And you can't ignore that evil side for this teeny tiny grain of
Your son still left. I actually have what might be considered as an unpopular opinion in the fandom, but I actually liked how things played out with Katrina and Henry. This entire scene when he was accusing her of being weak because she was human. And, you know, this entire conversation, how he was denying his humanity, and that was one of the reasons he was ahead of her, and he was playing her, and she played right into his hand and everything, and by being weak and needing to contact Crane and everything. And for me, this proved that not only she's a strong female character, but it also, I think from now on, I'm going to be using Katrina as a great example that a female character can be strong and still have weaknesses and still be in a way manipulated and, you know, played basically, and she doesn't have to win to still be strong, because yes, she got played and possibly, you know, made Ichabod and Abby's life more difficult in that episode. But at the same time, she had her agenda, and she was executing that agenda and accomplishing stuff and doing stuff. She didn't have all the information she needed to actually win or you know, be ahead of Henry. But it didn't stop her from acting and doing something. And hey, she's still alive at the end of the episode, so that's a win. So I think I really liked her.
I think this was, even though she wasn't in it that much, I think this was a good episode for her. Because I have to admit, at the very beginning when we see her in the mirror, doing this whole through the looking glass kind of thing. Yeah. I'm like, ugh, we're falling back to how she was in the first season, and it's not going to be, we've progressed past that. It worked in the first season, but it doesn't work anymore. Yeah. And she just seemed so, like, even the way, she was very soft. Like, they even did her makeup a little bit more soft in this episode, and her hair was softer. Everything about her looked more soft, except, of course, for that corset. Oh, poor woman.
It does not look comfortable.
No, a corset and skinny jeans. I
cringe every time
sorry.
I see her wardrobe.
But we digress. She seemed like she was taking these steps back. And then you're right, she does seem like, especially when he starts challenging that whole humanity is your weakness.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, this is a trope that's throughout everything. That's, you know, science fiction, fantasy, whatever you want to do, regular dramas and all this, is that whole thing of your weakness is your humanity. That's almost, I think, when she really starts realizing that it's not, that her humanity isn't the weakness. That she's so busy being trying to be this witch and have all these things and a player in this whole witness and blah, blah, blah kind of thing. And I have to get my son back. That almost seems like in this episode, she seems to have come back to herself. And yeah, I'm at that starting point and I'm not winning right now, but I'm not going to be compromised anymore.
Yeah.
And I think her, like you were saying, when Henry lifts the veil, okay, you want to see everything? Here you go. You got it all. She's going to be much more clear-headed about it. So I think this is a good turning point for Katrina.
Yeah, I think, in a way, Henry lifted the spell that was on her necklace to taunt her, right? It was so clear the moment he was doing it. It was a taunt. It was supposed to break her spirit even more. But I think that the result is going to be quite the opposite.
I think so too.
Because now that, her sight was clouded. She did not see things clearly. She did not work on full informations. You know, because if she saw the baby being actually, you know, little horned monster, she would react sooner, right? And now that nothing is clouding her judgment, basically, I think we are going to see a badass Katrina like we hoped we would when she came back from purgatory.
I think so. I think you're actually very right, because this episode was the one where I think, even in their small amount of screen time, where Henry, this 50-year-old man, he seemed most childlike.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed most taunting, most, you know, this kid that's got this plan. And like you said, he's taunting her when he lifts this veil. Really? You think everything's great? Well, look. And it's almost like, you know, if you kept the veil down, you would have kept her in this little world where she doesn't have the clarity. That was a great word you used. Where she doesn't have this clarity, where everything is clouded. And she's seeing things in one way. Him lifting the veil, he showed her who he was. She showed her what's really going on around. She has so much more information just from that.
Yeah.
Do not disappoint us, Katrina, because we are really excited about you now. We've now spent at least 10 minutes talking about you.
But how can we not talk about her? When, as long as the spell was going on, she was seeing what they wanted her to see. And that's a great metaphor for her entire situation. But now, no, now she's seeing things for what they are. And Henry, you're right. What Henry did was throwing a tantrum. Like, for God's sake, my 5-year-old niece threw those tantrums when she was 4. Like, because she's a big girl now, you understand?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, he threw a tantrum. And like any other parent, she saw what was going on the moment the kid threw a tantrum. And now she's back, and oh my goodness. And that's another thing, to go back for a tiny little second to my disappointment about Frank and Jenny. those scenes with Henry and Katrina, even though they were mm-hmm. equally as short as Frank and Jenny's scenes, they matched the intensity of the rest of the episode.
Right. Right.
As you can see by my excitement as I talk about them.
Oh, if only you people could see her.
I am really excited about this episode. So, yeah. Writers, do not disappoint me. You've done so in the past. You know, if you have to fail, fail better.
Something I also found very intriguing in this episode, and again, it didn't hit me until after I started after I finished watching this, how much it really meant, was we finally also had some non-Katrina backstory with Abe and Crane.
Mm-hmm.
We saw them before he even came to the colonies, when they have that whole sword battle,
mm-hmm.
fighting, you know, doing there. And Abe is convincing him to do this, and Abe is pulling him in. And so we see some of this Abe and Ichabod romance from the 1770s or so. Probably, yes, probably like early 1770s, since the beginning part was probably not anywhere near the Revolution time.
My journey for the sword must inevitably pass through Abraham, as has my life's journey to this point. Whoever I may be now, I owe my very identity to him.
America, Ichabod. Think on it. A new world, there for the taking.
You mock me, Abraham. You know I cannot simply resign my professorship to follow you to the colonies.
I thought university was your father's path. Not yours.
I'll choose my own path, thank you.
Perhaps. I know old Thomas will never support such a move, but join the army. Let the crown pay your way. I beg you, my friend, whatever it takes, act. For once in your life, become your own man.
Whatever man I may be, Abraham, I'm still your better.
Toy swords, pretend fighting. But come test yourself in the real world and decide, were you meant to teach history or to make it?
And now the swords are very real indeed. Don't you see, Lieutenant? Abraham made me who I am. Our journeys are entwined, our fates ever so. And now he too is on the quest for the sword.
You're saying the prophecy's real, self-fulfilling.
We shall meet in battle again. Only this time, he's the horseman of death. And I must know myself completely, or perish.
And then you see in their fight near the end, when they're really going at it with the sword and the axe. Talk about that a little bit more in a second too, I'm sure. And Abe is talking about how Crane forced his way into this. He's the one that imposed onto Abe's life. He's the one that did all of this stuff. And it got me thinking, is what we're seeing in the flashbacks actual fact, or is it how Crane saw what was happening then? It's, you know, because when you look back on what's happened, I mean, even when you and I look back on a podcast we've done, do we remember it the same? Because you're going to see it from your point of view and I'll see it from my point of view. So how much are we seeing is, well, we've talked about this before too, are we seeing the facts or are we seeing the way the character is remembering it? We were talking about that in the Weeping Lady episode.
Yeah, exactly.
With Katrina and that. So are we seeing Abe and Ichabod as Crane remembers it? Or is that fact? And what is, because Abe is so upset, so deeply hurt by what he perceives having happened.
I actually have been wondering about that since the Weeping Lady episode. Because when mm-hmm. we started to wonder whether how reliable Katrina is as a narrator, and as mm-hmm. she was relying the story of her meeting and everything, and I remember how doubtful we were about how objective that story was,
mm-hmm.
The way it was shown and all that, and ever since then I've actually been wondering whether or not to get back to the reference to Harry Potter, how reliable of a narrator Ichabod is in the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wouldn't be surprised at all if what we were seeing was his recollection and the way he perceived everything in the world around him through the incomplete information, you know, through his own emotions. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at even the flashbacks that we got in this episode, his flashback fight with Abraham, it was like a child's play, you know. They weren't really serious,
sparring,
right?
Yeah.
They were just
doing
what boys do, apparently, in 17.
Just sparring, learning, practicing sword fight. Yeah,
it wasn't even a practice. They were just, you know, playing around, basically. And especially when compared to the intensity of the axe versus sword. And it got me thinking, after this episode, I've been wondering about it ever since I finished the episode, on and off, because, you know, I have life and work. Or so I say. So I claim. But if we are seeing flashbacks that aren't reliable, A, there is a chance we will never actually learn what's happening, and B, it also leaves this idea that refuses to go away, at least, you know, as it came to me, it now refuses to go away. How much can we trust Ichabod as far as his information that he passes on to Abby? Because he always tells her stories, right? He tells her stories. He tells her those little facts about the revolution and everything. And now that there is this possibility of him being unreliable as a narrator, what if the information he passes on isn't 100% reliable? And what if at some point it's going to, forgive my French, bite him in the ass? Or not him, but, you know, Team Witness. Which, you know, makes Hottie and his information a little more reliable, because Hottie doesn't have an agenda of washing the facts.
He has an agenda, just not these kind of...
but what I'm trying to say is, when he's sharing his information about the monsters and the information that he has about the revolution and all that, he doesn't play a part in the revolution, and therefore he doesn't try to paint himself, even unconsciously. I don't even think Crane knows that he's coloring his recollections to make himself look better. He wouldn't be the first human being to do so without even a thought of that occurring to him.
Yeah, because Hottie's, he's a mercenary. I mean, he's softening up now, but he was very much dollar sign. I need this so I get the money, you know, and so going more in facts. You have even, which we've thought are really cute and wonderful the whole series long, but like at the beginning of this episode when they're doing the little game, which I'm like, the one over Abby's head is Cher. I'm like, does he know who Cher is? Is he going to be able to even give a clue for her to try and guess who Cher is? But when he ends up being George Washington and he calls him the liar in chief, you know, he says that, and then he talks about what he was lying about. Like, well, these are the same kind of lies you would be telling. They're spy lies, you know. They're not, it's not like he's going, well, yes, I have this many horses and this much land and I've saved the world and I've, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not, and the way he looks at Ben Franklin, the way he looks at all these things in the past, is he seeing it more as he wants to, so he also looks good, because he looks pretty darn good with all the information he has, every place he's been, everybody he's known.
So that's the idea that refuses to go away when I think about it. And I don't think it's something the writers are going to explore. Because it's too subtle, in a way, to make good TV unless they take somebody else. Because we are prone to believe Crane. Like, even if Abraham's version of the events is more, I don't know, closer to the truth, he's the villain. So we're not set to believe him because he's the horseman of death, right? So he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
So we are hardwired to believe Ichabod. What he's saying is true. And even if he, you know, embellishes some stuff and maybe like omits some minor tiny little details, they are not important because I was mean to this and this person, then yeah, let's not talk about it. So I don't think we will ever explore that, but I know that I would love to read a fanfic or, you know, read a essay from a fan or from somebody else exploring that side of possibility, basically. Because the idea is going to be there and it's going to stew, and at some point I am going to be watching this show through, like, gray glasses that will make me doubt Ichabod's every move. Because I'm going to be, you know, questioning everything he does. But for now, it's an interesting idea that I would like somebody else write about because, you know, I don't have time.
So if you have or want to write some fanfic on that, please let us know at Sci-Fi for Chicks on Twitter, sci-fi4chicks@sci-fi4me.com, on email, and of course, 573-42-SCI-FI. That's 573-427-2434 on the hotline. Would you like how I slip that in?
Yes, okay. Basically, feed my obsession. Thank you very much.
Please, please. I did really like that a complaint that I had. What was it, 2 episodes ago? When we were talking about everything. We love you, Sleepy Hollow. Now here's everything that's wrong.
Yeah, 2 episodes ago. Yeah.
Abe, headless, is back.
Yes.
And Abe has a spine. And Abe has a purpose. He's not this, you know, this brooding guy over in the corner who's just sad about his girlfriend liking some other guy over him. He had a purpose, and he had emotion. And I loved when Henry, he yells at Death. He's bossing him around. You got to go get that sword, and you better go do it now. It's like it almost made Death even more angry that War is bossing Death around.
Mm.
And he had more of a call. We saw Headless back. It was great to see Headless again, wielding that axe and the shotgun. Oh, that was so nice. And to have it, too, where when they came down into the chamber and they're doing that battle, that Crane got to see Abe's face again. But this is not his happy-go-lucky friend. This is not how Katrina sees Abe, where, you know, he's got these loving eyes. That hatred, that viciousness, that
rage.
Fight scene was fabulous. I mean, just on both of them, how the rage was in both of their faces and their bodies and their actions. I was really happy to see Headless back. And Abe as somebody other than this mealy mouth guy. You know,
what I loved the most, because, the fight was spectacular and so intense, and the argument they were having between the blows, it was what dreams are made of, basically. But what I loved the most was the end, because by the end of it, both of them, both Ichabod and Abraham, made a conscious choice of which side they're on, and it spoke volumes to me, which is probably one of the reasons why I'm so excited about this episode, because it was so organic, so natural, and the intensity of it didn't let up for a second. Everything was happening, and they were yelling accusations at each other, you know, blaming each other, and fighting and trying not to, you know, die on Ichabod's part, because Headless didn't care. But by the end of it, not only they didn't kill each other, because Abraham decided that death, as the, you know, horseman of death, he decided that death would be too easy for Ichabod. And it wasn't even about the link between them. It was Abraham deciding that, to quote, for some reason, Vampire Diaries, he decided that Ichabod deserved an eternity of misery. And Abraham is going to watch him be in pain, right, be miserable, be hurt, and that would be his reward for helping Moloch. And it was so powerful.
This, I think, is the first time that we've seen Abraham really embody what we saw in the first season with Headless.
Yes, exactly.
Abraham, every time we've seen him, has been Abraham. He's embodying that whole death, headless horseman of the apocalypse kind of thing.
Yeah.
But as Abraham.
Exactly.
Not just as headless. This was, I was very impressed by the actor bringing it this week.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, love a good boy battle there. it was kind of hot. Kind of hot there. Kind of hot.
No, they were amazing. Both Tom Meissen and Neil Jackson was just, oh my God. This is what we've been waiting for, even though we didn't know we needed it.
Exactly.
This was exactly what we needed. And
yeah,
that was perfect. And I think in this episode, Abraham had more character development than he did in the entire series. Since season one.
Leaps and bounds.
Pilot. It was like, whoosh, and he's this fully realized, not lovesick puppy, not mindless puppet, fully realized character.
Yeah.
That feels rage, that feels love, that feels betrayal, that makes his own decisions even though he is in service of Moloch. But right now he was more like Henry than a mindless puppet that we've seen him be most of the time.
Yeah.
And wow.
When he was actually able to get under Crane's skin. That scene, that shot, when there's almost this pause, he goes, you know, Katrina will keep coming back to me, and you know it's true. And that look on Crane's face.
Yeah.
Yeah. He freezes, and you can see, without much of his expression changing at all, you can see his insides just kind of like drop, like,
he's,
oh my
right,
gosh, this is true.
Yeah.
And Abe, just that little bit, Abe got that bolster. While Crane was deflating, Abe was you know, getting bigger and broader. It's like more power to him. And it was such a great moment, the play back and forth with them, and the battle scenes mixed with the dialogue were really wonderful and effective. And the lighting in it was, like you'd been saying way at the beginning, the lighting in the scene was incredible as well.
Yeah, basically, I have this overwhelming need to record the entire fight scene so I can rewatch it every time the show does something wrong. To remind myself how utterly brilliant they can be in planning, writing, and executing. Mm-hmm. Because that scene, that entire thing between them was pure gold.
Yeah.
And I will love it forever, honestly.
Yeah, it was beautiful. And speaking of the planning and the thinking, I love how Abby and Crane, when they're faced with our Gorgon, go, well, who
Selfie
can look at a
Gorgon,
but maybe somebody without eyes. So here at the end of the episode, when Crane is talking about how He's been pushed and shoved. He's been moved on his course by Abraham, by Katrina, by being a witness, by all these things. He hasn't really made the choices. They used Abraham a little bit there too to kind of get in and start getting what they wanted. And that was a brilliant move, because at first I'm thinking, oh, okay, we got to do the whole Perseus thing.
Dixon. It's Grace's last name. The clothing is early 19th century. This must have been one of her daughters or granddaughters or something. Why a statue?
I fear this is no statue, but a real person turned to stone. As they all are.
Green, what is that?
We need to leave. Now. Quickly, don't look back. Do not look back! Go! Go! Don't look!
Although, I will admit, the selfie with the Gorgon was a great moment. I love when you can throw in that, because that's actually very real, to throw in that little bit of humor at a really tense moment. So the selfie with the Gorgon was an awesome moment. But thinking, hey, let's send Headless in, because he can battle the Gorgon, and we don't have to worry about it, was brilliant. Abby!
Side note, that's actually my title ever since I've seen the episode. Sci-Fi for Chicks takes a selfie with a Gorgon.
That was an option, yeah.
That was an option. But their planning only emphasized what I said about this episode before. They were planning and moving ahead. They were, acting, doing something, and not reacting. So that was why I, loved that. Plus, I think if they did the whole reflection thing, I would then be forced to rant about them using overused tropes, which would bring my enjoyment of this episode from 11 to maybe 5. Because nothing annoys me more than overplayed tropes. So that they did something new, because nobody did it before, because nobody had a headless horseman at their disposal, I suppose. So, more power to them. But the entire idea, and then when it was after the fight, and they were, the headless had this retreat because he heard, the call to Moloch. Which, by the way, Henry said that he would have to blow the horn 3 times. We only heard one, so I feel kind of cheated.
Well, we do still have the mid-season finale, so...
How long does it take to blow a horn?
A lot of lung power.
I know. Yeah,
maybe he's older. Maybe he doesn't have the lung capacity.
I know isn't the youngest, but come on. anyway, going back to my actual point.
Digression, Sci-Fi for Me podcast.
Yeah.
Stamp of approval. Sorry.
Still, after Headless left and Abby and Ichabod were left in the chamber, you remember how I was when they hugged in Purgatory in episode 1?
Yes. It's season.
Season, yeah.
It was that long ago.
I still don't ship them. I still don't see them as a romantic couple.
No.
But when they stood there and Ichabod went, or was it Abby? No, Ichabod went... What do we have that those other people stuck being turned into stone out there don't have or didn't have?
Yeah.
And the answer was each other. And I melted because it was so perfect and made a point of their close dynamic and the bond between them. That it was like cherry on top of an amazing dessert, ice cream and whipped cream, and that was the cherry on top that made everything absolutely perfect. And I was like, this is my happy, shiny happy place, and I want to stay here forever and ever, and maybe let Jesse from Orphan Black come over and introduce him to Hottie for a second or two, because I'm in heaven and I want to stay here. I'm just saying.
Well, Abby is basically Crane's work wife. Mm. That's what she is. She's the work wife. they have this incredible connection, this incredible bond, and I've never been an Abby Ichabod shipper at all. I love that it just keeps getting deeper, though, in how spiritual, how you know, their connection is just so far past romance that to have them be romantic would almost trivialize.
Yeah.
Not almost. It would trivialize what their relationship really is and their bond.
I don't ship them either. And every time they have a scene like that, I'm just, oh my goodness, this is possibly the most awesome platonic, relationship I've seen in ages, because they trust each other so implicitly with everything. Mm-hmm. They rely on each other. They support each other. And there is no doubt. Abby can doubt her sister. Ichabod can doubt his wife. But I don't think there is a scenario in which they would doubt each other.
That would be like really bottom of the barrel for both of them if they got to that point.
Yeah, if there's anything that could break them as people, not as a team, but as people, if there's anything that could break them as people right now, it would be a scenario where the other one betrayed them in some way.
Yeah.
And every time they have this moment, I'm just sold all over again on the show.
Yeah. They have such a great, deep connection that they bring out the best of each other. This whole chamber is supposed to be Know Thyself, and it's just supposed to show, lift all veils and things like that. Side note, I love Abby freaking out over seeing Headless with a head.
Nice
little moment. He's got a head. I didn't think we had those anymore. I also really loved when she got upset about what's been happening to all of her ancestors.
Yeah.
By seeing this frozen, that was the one time the lighting wasn't that great. They kept showing the flashlight mm-hmm. on the face of her ancestor at, spitting image. And I'm like, really? I can't tell.
Department didn't do the best job.
Yeah, and the lighting was a little too harsh on that. But how she just, that finally came out, that all the Mills women have suffered based on her remembering that creepy You Are My Sunshine dream she had with Mama that led her to this place. Seeing Abby also, here she's got all that going on, but she's the one that brings him back. Turn it around and decide to live. Because life is a series of choices. She's the one that brings him back. And he's the one that's also bringing her back. He goes headlong in this Han Solo thing. And that first thing with Headless, before the sun came and shoot him away. But Headless is about to find Abby. And he does the whole Han Solo charge right in and run like this and run away. He's about to get blown away. And even when they're down in the chambers, Abby is the one. He knows that Abby's the one that's got to pick the sword.
Yeah.
And he's got to battle this. And they just so know their places and know each other and know how to reach to that person. Because he brings her back when she starts really feeling the loss of everything that the Mills women have suffered, and she brings him back when Headless almost has him doubting himself.
What I loved about that moment, I loved so many moments. It's just it seems like every 5 minutes I say what I loved about that moment. But yeah, what I loved about
you're sounding like me
was when she was freaking out. And, being, is this what I'm going to end up as? Dead in that chamber? Am I to join them? And she had this, it was clear that she was having the whole thing was hitting her more than ever before. Mm-hmm. Like, her dying was an actual option here, because that was something that could happen. When she was freaking out, he was trying to be supportive. But the moment she suggested that, am I going to die like that? He was like, no, I loved the lack of hesitation, because for him it wasn't even an option. No, that is not in the, you know, great array of terrible things that happen, that could happen to us. No, Miss Abby Mills is not going to die. I don't think he has this certainty about himself. I highly doubt it. I think for Ichabod, the option of him dying exists and is actually, you know, an option that could happen. But the idea that...
Well, it has happened.
Yeah. But the idea that Abby could die, even after, especially, I think, after Weeping Lady, where she did, you know, had the moment of being temporarily dead and Hottie had to revive her. And I think when she mentioned it, am I going to join them? Am I going to die here? He had this, he had to have this flashback to the Weeping Lady episode when she was lying on the floor, you know, dead, and she, and he didn't know how to help her.
Right.
So yeah, no, Abby dying is not an option. No.
No. No.
And I loved that. I loved that because there are certain things about Abby that he doesn't even allow himself to acknowledge. No, there is no, it's not an option for her to, you know, die. Get hurt, sure, but nope, no death for her.
Well, and he brings her back into a safe place.
Yeah.
Not because she's a damsel and needs rescuing, but reminding her of the safe place. She brings him back to reality. Whether it's, yeah, whether it's her saying, you know, you just had a shotgun to your chest. You know, you just need to take this, take a breath. You need to decide to live and choose this. Or it's her saying, yeah, 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 heaven and earth. And he's doing this whole grand thing of where it could mean, you know, where as above, so below, and he's doing this whole heaven and earth and mystical and blah, blah. And she's like, or maybe just down here underneath our feet. Yeah, she's good at bringing him back, reining him back in as he's going off on these.
Yeah, allowing him to have a, you know, be adorable puppy for a second and go on those
have your moment.
Yeah, have your moment. And what about this idea? That is clearly the right idea, because it's Abby. I'm just saying.
Very much, very, very much so. Before we get to our scale, I do want to give also some props to the editing department there, because they did some really great little edits. There is this one shot when they first go down into the chamber. And as it's starting to come to Crane, what all these statues actually mean, as he's turning around, but his flashlight is shining off behind him, we see the Gorgon just kind of peek into frame, just menacingly behind him.
I almost missed her. It was perfect.
Yeah, so did I. It was a beautiful shot. So if you didn't see it, go back and look at it, because it's very creepy. And in that battle between him and Abraham, watch that scene again, because he's fighting Abraham, and then we cut and he's fighting Headless, and then we cut and it's Abraham again. The editing back and forth was seamless, where it wasn't just this constant fighting Abraham kind of thing. There's these shots in there where he's headless, and they did some really great edits there in that, and I just loved it.
Those edits in that fight almost felt like they were switching points of view.
Yeah.
And that even added to how amazing that scene was. Those you know, fluctuating points of view was like I said, genius.
Just really, really loved that. And I have to admit, I loved the ending too. It was had the Harry Potter elements, the Arthurian elements, the Indiana Jones elements, you know, choose wisely on the swords, although they all ended up being snakes. But how they ended up coming up with the sword, working together with the fire, raising that sword, beautiful imagery there and how they did that. And then cutting to Malik and Henry and both horsemen, because we now have the horseman of war actually there on his horse.
Yeah, and but Malik he's there. He's the representation of Henry, so...
Henry, I think, needs to get something a little bit less old librarian looking like. His clothes are overly baggy. He needs to spiff up a little bit. But that end shot with all of them there, and you see those two pillars just waiting for Katrina to be put in the middle.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Abe doesn't care anymore about her just voluntarily turning. Angry. Nobody doesn't. And we have end scene, which is like, oh yeah, because this is the mid-season finale.
No, it's not.
It's not. It is not. And but next week's episode...
Honestly, it could be. It would stand on its own.
It could be, but it's not. And the next episode, it's episode 11 before our mid-season break. It's called The Akita, which, if you look up The Akita, it's one of the most important stories in Jewish, Christian, and Islamic tradition, and the root of God's promise to the Jewish people of land and forgiveness of sin. It's a huge, big religious story, which leads to the summary, unforeseen sacrifices must be made and loyalties are put to the ultimate test in the fight against evil. To use the word ultimate test in a mid-season finale, that takes some cojones there. The things that stood out to me, which I don't think you saw the trailer for next week, mm-mm, were, number one, Hottie is back. So we have Hottie.
Always a good choice.
Yay. I actually, though, did not miss him in this episode, but I'm really glad he's back.
Yeah.
Really glad he's back. We have a pentagram over the town. They're doing like the little points, so I'm guessing the ley lines, mm-hmm, and pentagrams may be coming out. We have Jenny talking about how, or Hottie says something about how, oh, there's like ice here. And she goes, it's raining blood. They're like these little frozen blood crystals, ooh, that have been raining down on them. They have Crane saying that he would lay his life. He would lay down himself for this. And then I think it was Abby said, but will you lay down your sons? Got a little choice there. And then the big title that they put over it said, someone must fall.
I do not like it when shows writers and producers, you know, go make it a big deal that somebody's going to die. Because that...
It just said fall.
No, come on.
They did say fall.
You know what they are aiming for. They want us to think that somebody's going to die. No. That's, come on, let's be
But they're realistic. Not saying somebody is. They're just wanting us to think that.
Yeah, but premises like that always mean one of two things. Number one, one of my favorite characters is going to get hurt and possibly die, which I don't approve of. Number two, I'm going to be let down because they are not going to live up to the hype they set up, which I also don't approve of because I don't like it when I'm disappointed in one of my favorite shows. So I'm always kind of, you know, why do they feel that their trailer, that the episode is not going to be enough for us to tune in? Come on, you don't need to threaten one of the characters for me to turn up because you left such a cliffhanger that I'm desperate to learn what's going to happen next. And thank God I don't have to wait 6 weeks or more, you know? So
you say that now. Wait till after next episode and we'll see what we're saying.
I have to
wait.
Do not destroy this.
Sorry.
But yeah, it's only next week. So why did they feel like they need to go, oh my God, somebody's going to fall. Gasp, you know, shock, plot twist. And my automatic response is usually, yeah, whatever. And my excitement just falls to the ground because...
See, when I first saw that, I'm like, oh no, somebody's going to die. And you start going through, okay, who could it be? But then after I started thinking about the whole Frank thing and his duality, his good and his
that might side be that's now tied to evil.
It might be a metaphorical fall, mm-hmm, and maybe it is something because Irving has been a very good guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's been a very good guy this whole series. Even when it came to, you want your soul back? Easy to do. Kill the guy who maimed your daughter for life. Soul for a soul. He still took the high road. He's taken the high road so many times. So maybe it's a metaphorical fall.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, okay. I like this version better.
I'm glad I could help.
You're welcome. This is what you're here for. You know?
This is what I do best. This is what I do best. Metaphorical.
That's your job.
High road.
Fixing, yeah, that's what I... you know, stuff.
It's totally a mercenary thing on my point. It's totally mercenary because, you know, if I can placate you and put you in your shiny, happy place, my life is that much better and easier. So it's totally for my own personal
I don't care about your motives as long as I'm happy.
So do we have a scale? What's our scale for this episode?
We do have a scale, but because I just couldn't find or decide on what our extremes should be, I just went with words. So, and yes, because, you know, I'm a writer and I do English. I have no problem coming up with words, said Alex.
So you say.
Okay, so, but seriously, on a scale of let's just be friends to I want to have your babies. We're on that scale, and yes, you are allowed to use a cinematic or television example. Would you put Ichabod and Abby's relationship dynamic interactions from this episode?
Okay, so since we don't have film titles as extremes in our scales, I'm going to use something from film, but it's their relationship as a whole, not a particular film. Although I think there's one particular moment in a film that exemplifies all of that. And this is going to go to one of my earliest sci-fi fantasy obsessions. And that's going to be Luke and Han in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically in The Empire Strikes Back. Because one of my favorite things actually in... I'll tell you, actually, my two favorite storylines are... the true love that can't be, you know, where there isn't the happy ending. Mm-hmm. There's some reason that they can't be together, like a good reason, not just because. And that, yeah, just because I don't, yeah. A good reason of why they can't be together.
Mm-hmm.
The other favorite story really is this bond that is so deep. This friendship that is so much more than the word friendship.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just this psychic tie, which... when you'd said earlier in the episode, you were talking about that, this psychic link that these two seem to have, that they don't even really have to talk, that it's just there, this connection between them. There's a moment in The Empire Strikes Back when Han's trying to get the Falcon ready to fly off Hoth and go save everything, and Luke's getting ready to go to his X-Wing to battle the AT-ATs, and he comes to say goodbye. And there's this moment when Luke's about to say something, and Han just kind of shakes his head and Luke shakes his head and they just look at each other. And you know that they've said everything there is to say about what they really feel about each other, about how they trust each other, what their feelings are for them, what they want them to accomplish. Everything is in that moment. And I see it throughout all of the original trilogy between Luke and Han. There is just that bond that is more than brothers, even though they end up being brothers in a way. I love that moment right there about, it's so deep. It's more than friends. It's more than fellow fighters. It's more than their tie because of Leia. It's just, so it's my all time favorite platonic bond type moment. So that's mine.
Yeah. And in a similar way that you don't name, you know, pick a movie title to explain the relationship and all, I also kind of don't want to pick any other relationship that I've seen so far to compare Abby and Ichabod to, because you know how when we rate something on a scale of 1 to 10 and we go with 11 or 12?
Yeah.
I really do feel like the relationship that Abby and Ichabod have transcendence and just goes beyond any scale that we could possibly put them on. no other character dynamic that I've seen, and I've seen a lot of them, is even remotely similar to the kind of deep, eternal even bond that they share right now. And if I had to, no other... I do not have a reference.
You've got to quantify it in some place, because it's your scale, Chicky. So you got to quantify it in somehow.
See, but I'm the one setting up the rules, so I'm going to break them. Because, ha! Basically, I am being very mature right now. But I refuse to put them next to any other couple, any other friendship, any other pairing, because I really do believe that anything that they share is much more than anything anyone else ever experienced. Because on the scale of 1 to 10, they are 12. And on the scale of let's just be friends and I want to have your babies, is no matter the years, no matter where we are going to be bound together for the eternity and even beyond that. Because they are epic. That's what
I'm going to say. It kind of relates to that. There's two cultures in our final states that joined the Union, in Alaska and Hawaii. In Alaska, you have the native population, the Inuits and such, that here we have this one thing that we call snow, but snow is so important to them, they have hundreds of words for what snow is. We just look at snow and it's snow, but they have so much more, it means so much more to them. Similarly, in Hawaii, we have this one word that's aloha, which a lot of people just think it means hello or goodbye, but it doesn't. It's this whole feeling that permeates the Hawaiians and Hawaiian culture that means so much more than hello, goodbye, and love. It means a multitude of things in this one little five-letter word. So
basically, Ichabod and Abby are like snow and aloha and all those.
They're aloha snow.
Yeah. if I have to settle on words, which as a writer I should probably, but hey, who cares? It would be snow. Yeah, it would be snow and aloha and any other word in any other culture that has a multitude of meanings, because they are, what they are is not simple, what they are is not easily defined, but it means so much that it's pretty much overwhelming at times.
So for you, like in math, where you made a scale that was very linear, they became like the third dimension.
Yes.
They went off that
yes.
two dimension into the third
basically.
Dimension.
Because I adore them, and their relationship is...
Really?
They are amazing. They are so original in their dynamic that I can't get over them. I just love them. If they were
So writers...
keep doing
writers,
what you're
don't
doing.
F that up.
Yeah. Oh, you do not want
do
to
not...
get me angry. Do not destroy my perfect canon.
Don't make her angry. You wouldn't like her when she's angry.
Unless they heard my rant about Deliverance. I'm just saying.
No, the episode that must not be named. That's
it didn't happen, I know. It didn't happen.
We will be back to talk about the mid-season finale, The Akita. Thank you so much for sticking with us in this. It's a supersized episode today.
Again.
One episode. We didn't even go this long on the episode where we talked about three episodes in one.
Yeah.
We are also going to do a mid-season break kind of recap, looking back over the first half of the season, as well as talking about some interviews that we've seen, what we've read with the showrunner about what has been happening this first half of the season, what fans' reactions were, and what they're telling us that we should do about that and our reactions to them. So, Alex, I will see you next as we talk about The Akita. Thank you so much for joining me in lovely episode where we actually had wonderful things to say about pretty much everybody.
Yeah.
Except for Jenny. And we didn't have bad things to say about her. We just didn't have things to say.
Mm. Hopefully that's going to be, you know, different next week. Hint, next week.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi for Chicks because, you know, it's the cool thing to do. Go over and like and follow sci-fi4me.com on the social media of your choice. And, of course, subscribe to Chicks and the other Sci-Fi for Me podcast on iTunes. We will see you next for the Akita. Until then, have wonderful fantasies about the beautifulness that is Abby and Ichabod and what could possibly happen with Crane and Abraham and Katrina and Frank. That's not going to happen now. We have this wonderful storyline going with Katrina and Frank, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Sad. And the return of Hottie, for those of you who like Hottie.
Like us.
If it's just me and Alex, we're fine with that.
Mm. I was never good at sharing my toys.
She's not. Thank you so much. I'll see you next time.
See
bye-bye.
You next time.
This has been a presentation of sci-fi4me.com. Copyright 2014 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media.